Oh, I mean, there's been so many highs. Seeing the devolution of policing and justice actually in place, and with a justice minister, which is unique in Northern Ireland's history. The excitement of the Giro d'Italia and the G8, and then the Queen's visit, and reading, you know, that people saying that wouldn't have been possible just a few years ago, and that's very encouraging indeed. I've had so many private and quiet conversations with people across the whole of Northern Ireland who are getting on with their lives and feeling safer and more secure because of the work of my colleagues. So there's been many, many, many highs. There's been some very, very sad times too. There's nothing worse than the murder of a colleague and the terrible impact that has on their families. And we lost Ronan Kerr, Philippa, David Black, and our colleague Adrian Donoghue, who's a Garda colleague. So there's been some lows, but overwhelmingly, you know, it's a great place of optimism at the moment, and you haven't got to go too far to find some hope.
Well, taking you back to what you mentioned about Ronan Kerr, the attack on Pádraig Heffron as well, David Black, obviously, the severe dissident threat, there have been some lows during your tenure here. Do you feel that you personally have made progress with the dissident threat here?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, they remain dangerous, and their threat level remains severe, and they can on occasions, plant bombs, as we've seen over the last 6 months. But when I took over in 2009, we had a real upsurge, and that threatened the peace process itself. I mean, it was a real challenge to the devolution of policing and justice. It was a challenge to people coming and investing here and giving their money to create jobs. And, you know, we had to deal with it. And I was very fortunate the government provided £250 million at my request. We've invested that. And sadly, you know, nearly 300 people now have been prosecuted for terrorist offences, and McGabbery is very full. So they haven't been able to rebuild, they haven't been able to regroup. I think it's a huge sadness, and I really do encourage anybody that is still committed to violence to recognise that politics actually does work here. Everybody can have their voice, and the PSNI is certainly not the enemy. It's dealing with domestic violence, child exploitation, drugs. It's there on behalf of everybody and proves itself day in, day out. So there's absolutely no excuse for violence whatsoever.
But yet there still is this small group in Northern Ireland that is intent on causing violence, making disruption. I mean, even the likes of the bomb that we saw in the Everglades Hotel in Derry earlier this year. Do you feel that the message just hasn't got through to these people?
I think some people still, for whatever reason, wake up in a world of hatred and go to bed in a world of hatred. It's an illogical hatred. It has no meaning on where peace is going. It hasn't broken the political institutions, and it won't. And I think the answer for them is either to join into the politics or go to prison. I think it really is time for any paramilitary, be they dissident Republican or loyalist, to recognise that the vast, vast majority of people want rid of them.
Well, turning towards then the loyalist side of things, we've obviously had the ongoing flag protest. There's been some PSNI, or criticism of the PSNI and how they've handled those weekly protests down at City Hall on Saturday, the violence that's ensued from some of them. If this had been handled differently by the PSNI, do you feel that it would still be ongoing? Would it still be an issue? Or have you any regrets on how it was handled?
If it had been handled differently, we could have seen a real challenge to the political institutions falling apart. But I think people forget that on one night alone last January we had 84 separate protests and riots at the same time, and because we prepared with half the people we had just 10 years before, we increased the training of officers to do with public order, bought new Land Rovers, we dealt with public order equipment, and I was into discussions with my colleague in England and Wales that I could fly over hundreds of people if we needed them, and that was in 2010-11. So we recognised that the world was not going to be one with the army, that if we had widespread protests, we had to be able to deal with it. And because of that foresight, we were able to deal with it. But it's an impossible task to deal with such widespread disorder with limited numbers of people without simply containing it and then bringing people to justice later. And we were praised by the United Nations. We were praised by the Human Rights Commissioner. We were praised by people for what we did. And it was the first time in 40 years that military hadn't been used to deal with widespread disorder. So I take the criticism about some of the day-to-day tactics, and it looked very messy, but we've ended up with 700 people prosecuted, not a single person seriously injured, and dialogue still going on. That's pretty. I think that's a pretty solid achievement for my colleagues, actually.
Well, again, then, we are moving into what we're in parading season. We still, as I said, have this ongoing protest up at Tweddale. I mean, that has, you mentioned earlier about the distant threat and bringing extra resources in. The money that they is taking to police up at Twaddell, what are your thoughts on that? And even the fact that where it is, it's intimidating to the people who live in the area?
Well, people feel very strongly about rights, and our job simply as the police is to enforce the law. Whether that's a praise commission determination, whether it's actually public order legislation, our job is to make sure that people can protest peacefully, but if they break the law, then they're held accountable for it. I think it's a sadness to me that there hasn't been sufficient local dialogue to bring about a solution. Clearly, there hasn't been enough give and take yet on all sides to do that, and that those conversations need to continue. And I think it's one of the few occasions I spoke at in my 5 years when I thought that there wasn't sufficiently strong political messages about the need to adhere to the rule of law. So, you know, this situation does need to be dealt with. At the moment, we're spending tens of millions of pounds that should be spent on dealing with drugs, you know, tackling the drug problem, dealing with child exploitation, stopping human slavery, managing cybercrime, helping people, victims of domestic violence. That money can't be spent twice. And whilst it's being spent on police officers standing on the front line, it's not being spent on keeping people safe in other areas.
But ultimately, as it's a mostly majoritively peaceful protest, it's not something that overly concerns you?
I think it concerns me because it is always there, and we always have to police it in sufficient numbers to make sure it doesn't become a problem and to protect all communities down there. Mm-hmm. And it has cost an awful lot of money, and there's always the possibility, of course, that things escalate. So I do hope, both at the political level, there are solutions to the past and the parading and the flags found very quickly, but also that there is a local solution to that particular issue of the parading on the 12th of July.
Well, the 12th of July is rapidly approaching. We did have dialogue between community groups and local representatives, but there still is an issue up in Ardoyne, the Twaddell Avenue area.
Yeah.
What are your fears moving to this 12th of July?
I think it's far too early. I mean, we find that obviously the tour went very well. Thank you to everybody for their calmness and patience in that. We've got more to come still. You don't really know how the 12th is going to play out until the Praise Commission makes its determination, and then we see how people react to that. But I think, you know, all I think I would encourage those involved to think about is it really isn't worth people getting criminal convictions, setting back all the enormous progress in the last few months because of an event on a single day. So please do try to work together. And if you don't like the determination, please respect it.
Well, and something else that's happening next month then that we've heard today is Lady Justice Hallett's inquiry into On the Runs is being published next month. Ian Paisley Jr. has come out today and said that he wants the government to prove ultimately that these letters are completely worthless. Do you feel the PSNI has a duty as well to prove that? Is it possible to do so?
The letters themselves were letters given to individuals at that moment in time, and we have a legal obligation to clarify with people what information we hold, and that's what was being done. So although the process was a political one, it's not for me to comment on that. The PSNI acted for the vast majority of those cases. I know there was a mistake in the Downey case, but our job is just to do that, do what the law demands. In my view, they were never amnesties. They're not amnesties. They are simply statements of fact at a moment in time. So if new evidence comes to light, if there's new information, then people can still be brought before the courts. And that in fact, has happened.
It's quite possible then we could see somebody behind bars who's received one of these on the run.
It is possible, yeah.
Okay. How likely do you think that is?
I think it depends on the individual cases. I mean, there's been advances in forensic science. Witnesses always come forward. There's always, in some cases, evidence coming together, and that's our obligation under the law to prosecute people. I mean, there are cases still under investigation. We're reviewing them all. I wouldn't want to give a figure on that, but as I said, those letters were statements of fact at the moment in time. They are not amnesties.
Well, the PSNI has recently been criticised, and yourself specifically, over the refusal to hand over historic information. The police ombudsman is suing you directly.
Well, he's suing. He was proposing to take us to court,
yeah.
And this has been played out as something of a conflict between me personally and Michael Maguire. It's not anything to do with personal. We're now in a world where we have a devolution of policing and justice, and the legislation that tells me what I can provide and what I don't provide is set out in a number of Acts of Parliament in the 1990s, 2000, 2003. And we hold some very sensitive information that is potentially life-threatening. And therefore, to hand that over to anybody, we need to make sure that we're doing it within the law. And the law isn't clear. So we've been having conversations with the Ombudsman, and he has a different approach to that of his predecessors about how we might do that. And we've been doing that between the lawyers. So it's not a conflict. This is sometimes when you're dealing with very sensitive issues and the law isn't clear, you have to go to court to test it. And that's not a dispute, that's a reality. And the very rare occasions it gets to court, then that's necessary. But I'm not in any dispute with the Ombudsman, however it's been portrayed. We're just testing the law.
Well, as well as it coming across, although you deny that there is an issue with the police Ombudsman, for the families of those who were murdered, these murders that they're looking into, do you feel that this has affected an already strained relationship between the PSNI and those victims' families?
I think you have to be very careful about how something that's so sensitive is portrayed. And I have no problem whatsoever in providing information. We give thousands of bits of information to the Ombudsman day in, day out. He has a huge amount of information, but just sometimes some information which is forbidden, or we think it may be forbidden by the law to be passed over in a certain way, we have to clarify that. So I hope that the families of victims are assured that there is nothing here in terms of blocking, denying. To be frank, why would I do that? What's in it for me? Nothing. And this portrayal of me as somehow being obstructive is nonsense.
Moving on then to it being your final day with the PSNI, how do you feel the force will move on in your absence? Where do you see the PSNI going after your departure?
Well, we have a huge amount of optimism in this organisation. I have some incredibly professional, courageous people, and I have no doubt that this is the finest police service in the world. And I can say that because I've been across the world and I've seen others, and this is the best. Confidence in policing is the highest it's ever been. It's risen four times faster than anywhere else in the United Kingdom in the past few years. I have officers working in every community now being accepted and respected. We're doing some fantastic work in dealing with the most vulnerable. We have a Rowan Centre now dealing with the victims of sexual violence, which is a world leader. We have the lowest crime levels for 15 years, and that's brilliant. It means that people feel safe. We have dealt with a huge challenge in terms of the terrorism, and we've dealt with the big challenge of the public order, and we've still had the G8 and the Giro. So I'm very, very proud. Where will it go? I think, but people have to get behind George Hamilton. He's an incredibly able professional colleague. I'm delighted he's the chief constable. He's his own man. He'll make his own decisions. But I have every confidence that provided he's provided with the resources he needs, and that's a political issue, the PSNI will continue to go from strength to strength and will continue to be that very, very personal, impartial service that everybody wants.
One of the things whenever you came into control power here, when you assumed your position as Chief Constable, you were very much an advocate of neighbourhood policing. Do you think that is what will be your legacy here?
I hope that's part of it. Although the credit for that goes to my colleagues who have taken on, you know, being very visible. They've got modern mobile data terminals. They're spending more time on the beat. They accept the fact that people get rung back and say, "How did you do?" All this is very, very new, and it's working very well indeed. And the credit for that goes to them. And there's no doubt that policing with the community, or the community policing, has made huge strides because of them. But it's more than that. I think we are uniquely in a world where budgets are very tight. We're half the size we were just a few years ago. And we manage mass disorder without the army. We manage that without anybody being seriously injured. We've dealt with an upsurge of terrorism. I think that's part of the story. And we're now in a place, in spite of some of the controversies, where politicians are working together, where the Queen can come and visit, say, you know, George's Market, and people talk about that not being possible a few years ago. We've got American investment, Japanese investment, Chinese investment. We've got some fantastic hope for the future. And hopefully that will be the story when people look back with hindsight.
One of the things that came through today, just actually before I left the office, was a press release from Trevor England describing you as an honest, hard-working cop. Do you think that's a view that's shared by others, our main parties within the executive?
I've had some lovely, because I'm leaving a little bit early, and rightly so, because the new chief needs to start as soon as possible, and he needs to, you know, have the opportunity to build those relationships. I've had some lovely conversations with politicians privately. One of the things I've learned about Northern Ireland, because it's post-conflict, is sometimes what's said publicly actually isn't meant. Sometimes it's the private and quiet conversations that really matter. And in the last few weeks, I've had some lovely words and letters of encouragement from people that I might not have expected. And I think they recognise that the PSNI is really doing what it should do, in spite of sometimes the fact that there was politics playing into the media. So I'm grateful for Trevor. I hadn't seen that, actually. He's one of my heroes now for saying that. I'm very grateful. You're listening, Trevor. Thanks very much, mate.
Well, finally, I just want to ask you, you have never been quiet about the fact that you're a Christian. How do you think that's helped you in your 5 years here?
It's the reason why my wife and myself came here. It was our very strong sense of calling to be part of this journey. I haven't done that perfectly, but I've tried my best. Hopefully people recognise that. I have a great strength in it, and a God that I believe is very present and in all of our lives. And actually is a God who's very simple and just says, get to know me. And sometimes we overcomplicate that. And over the 5 years, I've been able to visit many, many churches where barriers between themselves and other denominations have come down. I've eaten Ulster fries. I've eaten Ulster fries, so many of them. I've eaten bacon rolls. I've had tray bakes. I've had cake. I've opened church kitchens. I've been to churches in Derry, in Lurgan, in Strabane, in Bally this and Bally everywhere. I have been to so many places where I've seen just lovely people coming together as friends, be they Catholic, Protestant, Church of Ireland, Presbyterian, Elam. You know, they're just becoming friends. That, I think, has been part of the blessing for me of being here as a Christian man.
Okay, well, I know I asked you off before I started recording, but moving on then, you're still a young man. Where are you going from here?
Would you say that again? Because I... You're still a young man. Oh, so kind.
Shall I put relatively?
You can say that. You're still a young man. I'm going to have a break. I'm very fortunate. I can have a couple of months because I'm going back a little bit earlier. We're going to spend time with the family. I'm going to spend some time thinking about what I think I'm meant to do for the future. And then I'll make a decision. But I've had 37 years of this job. It's been a great privilege since I was 18. And I want to make sure the next part of my life I'm in the right place. So I don't know what I'm going to do yet, except probably dig, fish, meet the family, see some friends, and watch with great interest how things evolve in the next few months.